At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, a bit of oil, a bit of giving, and yeah, a bit of the Oscars. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, March 28th. Good to have you with us. All right, so let's start off with a bit of oil news, shall we? Crude oil prices were down today on news that Shanghai is locking down because of the latest COVID outbreak. That might dampen global energy demand, but still, with the war in Ukraine and the Russia sanctions and OPEC not doing much to increase global supplies, crude oil prices are still well over $100 a barrel, which, of course, is hitting gas prices. According to AAA, gas is averaging $4.24 a gallon nationwide, which honestly sounds great compared to the $6 I'm seeing here in Los Angeles. But anyway, to help alleviate the pain we're feeling at the pump, some states have been stepping in. Maryland, Georgia, and Connecticut have all temporarily suspended their gas taxes, and a few other states are now considering doing the same. That all sounds good, right? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Paying for gasoline, it's pretty annoying right now, says Mark Hamrick at Bankrate.
No one buys it because they love it, right? In other words, you have to have transportation. It literally burns into thin air.
No wonder some state lawmakers are temporarily eliminating gas taxes to reduce that irritation.
On average, state gas taxes are about 37 cents a gallon.
Jared Walczak is at the Tax Foundation.
That's less than 10% of the price of gasoline at the pump right now.
That price is up $1.40 a gallon, or nearly 50% from a year ago.
That's a lot.
But
the gas tax is a relatively small portion of that, and I understand it's the element that's within policymakers' control. They're capable of suspending that. A state policymaker can't do anything about broad inflation, let alone what's going on in Ukraine.
He warns it's bad fiscal policy.
It severs the link between driving and the maintenance of the roads. Gas taxes are a good tax that fund road maintenance and construction in a pretty good proxy for individuals' use of those roads.
Critics also point out that working people are struggling with inflation for all the necessities of life, not just gasoline. Chuck Marr is at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
We're seeing these sharply rising prices in food, in overall energy. And low-income people just don't have the cushion to deal with such shocks.
He says far better than a few states suspending gas taxes would be for Congress to restore the expired child tax credit that was helping families pay their soaring gasoline, heating, and electricity bills every month. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the major indices closed up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. not sure if you heard or not, but the Oscars happened last night. I don't know, maybe you saw a headline or two about that. Aside from that one noteworthy moment, which, don't worry, we're not going to get into here, it was a night of some historic firsts and historic wins. Troy Kotsur took Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Coda. He's the first deaf man to win an acting Oscar. That movie, Coda, also took Best Picture, making it the first time the night's biggest prize went to a streaming service, in this case, Apple TV+. You could say it was a tectonic shift for an industry that's been slow to embrace these platforms. So, what does this milestone mean for the industry? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
It used to be winning Best Picture gave movies an edge at the box office. But making money on the movie isn't really what Apple is going for, says Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor for The Hollywood Reporter.
To sign up for Apple costs $4.99 a month. You can't get a small popcorn at AMC for $4.99.
And an Oscar for Coda likely won't attract many long-term subscribers either, says Ross Benish, an analyst for Insider Intelligence.
Apple TV Plus has one of the highest cancellation rates among streaming services because there's nothing there. You could watch everything on the service within a few months and then cancel it.
Competitors Netflix and Amazon Prime have giant libraries, but Apple's strategy has been to invest exclusively in a small number of high-end original productions. Winning big awards reinforces their brand of quality over quantity, says Charles Schrager, a marketing professor at NYU.
They get bragging rights.
With artists in the industry and discerning consumers, Schrager compares it to what HBO did with prestige television in the cable era.
The Wire is one of those shows that people talk about, but not many people have seen. But you feel good as a consumer about being a part of that club.
And for Apple, that club is about a whole ecosystem of premium products and services, one that now includes feature films. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Okay, so I think it's fair to say that most of us have been in this situation before. You're at the checkout line buying a frozen pizza or a bag of hot Cheetos or maybe some vegetables because you're healthy, whatever. And then the cashier or the machine you're operating in lieu of a cashier asks you the question, would you like to round up your purchase to benefit a charity? If you say yes, you'll walk away having donated less than a dollar. But the question is, how many people actually say yes? In other words, how much change does it take to actually make a change? From a street corner in Brooklyn, Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on it.
Sometimes making a purchase comes with ethical quandaries. Like last week for this story, I booked a car with Lyft to get back to my apartment for my son's school.
It'll be about a 10-minute ride. It won't be too long. It's about a 25-minute walk. Or 30, if I'm dawdling. Sometimes I dawdle.
The Lyft app asked me if I wanted to round up to the next dollar to support Ukrainian refugees.
So it's $10.99, so the roundup wouldn't be a lot.
I did it because it was, you know, only a penny. It turns out a lot of people say yes when they're asked to round up, whether it's in a Lyft or in a store.
I remember standing right at the exit doors asking myself why.
Katie Kelting is a professor of marketing at St. Louis University. She said yes to rounding up her purchase for charity at a Petco store. She asked herself why, because other times when she'd been asked to give a whole dollar, she'd always said no. And she wondered what was different about rounding up.
We started testing to see if I was weird or not, and I wasn't.
Kelting asked her local zoo to be part of her research. It had already been asking for a dollar whenever someone bought something. You know, here is your corn dog. Would you give a dollar to help the prairie dogs? For the experiment, Kelting had the zoo switch and asked customers if they wanted to round up their purchases instead of giving a whole dollar. Turns out more people agreed to round up.
And so this percentage of people saying yes to the roundup kind of takes off and accumulates more, you know, brings in more overall money.
About 21% more, even though every single donation was less than a dollar. Kelting also did research in a lab setting to explore why more people said yes to rounding up. And she says the reason is it hurts less.
Even though donating does have this positive feeling associated with it, they call that like warm glow, it is a financial loss to consumers. and financial losses are painful.
In other words, people don't really want to give until it hurts. And lessening their pain has actually become a business. Braden Feinberg is the CEO of the company Roundup App, which allows people to round up every single purchase they make for charity.
So we're operating really as that middleman that makes it easy for the nonprofit to opt in, makes it easy for the consumer to make these connections.
Feinberg says the average Roundup user ends up donating about $30 a month. His company also works with merchants that want to ask customers to round up at checkout. He says people are more likely to say yes in that situation when the charity they're being asked to donate to meshes with the thing that they're buying.
If I'm purchasing a pack of baseballs and I see an option to round up for an after-school program that takes kids to play sports, you're much more likely to say yes because you identify with that story.
Another study found that identifying with the salesperson who's asking for money also matters. People are more likely to donate if they like the service. In New York, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Over the last couple of years, more federal money has flowed into Native American communities than really ever before. In 2020, the first coronavirus relief package, also known as the CARES Act, set aside $8 billion for tribal governments around the country. Then around this time last year, they got $20 billion in aid through the American Rescue Plan. This help has been called a potential Marshall Plan for revitalizing tribal communities and for closing the infrastructure gap in Indian country. Marketplace's Savannah Marr takes a look at how that money is being put to use.
When the pandemic arrived, tribes weren't exactly counting on help from the federal government. That's according to Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis of the Gila River Indian Community near Phoenix. After all, he says,
the high rates of COVID and other health disparities in Indian country comes from decades of underfunding, right, of a lack of investment.
So when help did arrive in the form of an initial $40 million from the CARES Act, Gila River's leadership invested it in healthcare, expanded ICU capacity, a field hospital, and a surveillance testing program when COVID tests were hard to come by elsewhere.
We had to really create our own path to protect our community. And by now, are moving towards nearly 1 million tests. That translates to over 5% of all tests conducted in the entire state of Arizona.
Halfway across the country in northern Wisconsin, the pandemic shed light on another problem, says Chairman Ron Korn of the Menominee Tribe.
We found out all too well how much connectivity we were missing or absent.
Tribal employees couldn't telework, kids couldn't log on to virtual school, so the Menominee Tribe is using federal aid to connect hundreds of rural homes to fiber. Korn says this is just one long overdue project the tribe has put off because it didn't have the funding.
I don't know what the words are. You know, unprecedented is what comes to mind, but it scratches the surface in regards to what our actual needs are.
Like transportation infrastructure on the rural reservation and more safe and affordable housing. And those infrastructure needs are the federal government's responsibility, says Tracy Morris with the American Indian Policy Institute at Arizona State University.
We have a treaty relationship with the United States, federal trust responsibility.
Tribal nations ceded millions of acres of land that now make up the United States in exchange for services, things like healthcare, housing, education, public safety.
Make no mistake that this is not racial preference. We are a political entity. These things are due to us because we are part of the family of governments in the United States.
But Morris says it took a pandemic and a lot of Native people dying for the federal government to take that trust responsibility seriously. She calls pandemic-era aid the first earnest attempt at making good on it.
So the impact of this is going to be huge in any country. There's no way it won't be because we've never had an investment in our infrastructure. It's offensive to a lot of us that we had to die for it to get realized.
These investments won't just benefit tribal citizens. Take the Osage Nation in northeastern Oklahoma. It's based in a rural county that's considered a food desert, and it's used federal funds to expand its vegetable growing operation and build a USDA-certified meat processing plant. Jan Heyman with the tribe's Natural Resources Department says it's shoring up the local food supply chain and insulating it from disruptions.
We've really tried to look at food security and food sovereignty really on the entire spectrum. We can build this infrastructure that we need. We can fill this gap.
Tribal leaders say the federal government has never been so engaged with their needs than in the last 2 years. Now, they're wondering whether that engagement and the resources that come along with it will last beyond the pandemic. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace. Coming up,
we've already groomed over 1,500 dogs.
That's a lot of dogs. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones picked up 94 points, 0.2% to close at 34,955. The Nasdaq lifted 185 points, 1.3% to finish at 14,354. And the S&P 500 found 32 points, 0.7% to end at 4575. President Biden released his 2023 federal budget today. The size? $5.8 trillion. That includes a 4% defense spending increase to $813 billion and more than $32 billion to fight domestic crime. The budget would also hike taxes on corporations and the super rich. We heard from Megan earlier about the film Coda from Apple streaming service and how it collected the Best Picture Oscar award. Apple rose 0.5% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.45%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. If you live in a rural town, finding a good lawyer, or even just a lawyer in general, can be tough. Take Maine, for example. In rural parts of the state, more than 60% of the attorneys are over the age of 50, and there aren't as many younger lawyers to replace them. So local lawmakers and college officials there are pushing for a new plan to help fill those gaps by sending law students to work in one far-flung town. From Maine Public Radio, Robbie Feinberg reports.
Lawyer Toby Jondreau didn't quite realize the extent of the need for legal help in Fort Kent, Maine, until he moved back to the area about 12 years ago.
I had the Ryder truck in the driveway. We're unpacking it. And my dad pulls in the driveway and he says, I got a call this morning as somebody wondering when you're opening, where your office is going to be, because they needed help. I didn't have my bed unpacked yet, and they knew that I was coming, and they needed help.
At the time, Jondreau says, there was just one general practice lawyer covering cases from divorces to protection orders in the small, isolated town located near the Canadian border, about a 5-hour drive north of Portland. The situation isn't much better today. In Aroostook County, where Fort Kent is located, it can take 2 hours or more to travel from one courthouse to the next. Yet local court clerks say only about 20 attorneys are available to take indigent legal defense cases. And many aren't from the area. That means lawyers from other regions are routinely brought in. They either drive hours to the courthouse or communicate through phone or Zoom.
A lot of us are just getting burnt out. I mean, I stopped taking court appointments because it just became unmanageable.
Now the Maine legislature is looking to step in. Maine Senate President Troy Jackson, who lives in nearby Allegash, says he's heard about those legal challenges from his own constituents.
We all understand that you have the right to legal counsel, but you know, but what good is that if you don't have the ability to get that legal counsel?
That's what prompted him to introduce a bill that would bring practicing law students into the county in order to help fill that gap.
Too many people leave our area to practice or try and get, you know, to become a practicing attorney. And oftentimes they don't come back. And, you know, I just thought that if there's a way to actually do some of the training in Aroostook County, you know, we might be able to actually draw some people.
Under the 3-year pilot program, students at the University of Maine School of Law would still spend the first half of their education on the school's campus in Portland. But after their first few semesters, 2 or 3 students at a time would head to Fort Kent, where they would work under the supervision of a professor in a satellite office of the college's student legal aid clinic. They'd receive academic credit for their work and stay at the dorms of another state college campus in town. Their clients would primarily be people with low incomes who can't afford to hire an attorney of their own. The total cost for the program, about $340,000 a year. Law school dean Lee Softley says she hopes that if students spend time in rural Maine and make connections with other lawyers, more may consider settling down there when they graduate.
And also see what it's like to be part of a community and be part of these beautiful places in the state of Maine. They're excited. They want to be there. But if they're just reading about it, the same connection doesn't get made.
The proposal is still winding its way through Maine's legislature, but it did receive initial approval from the Maine House and Senate. Officials hope that eventually clinics could be set up in other rural pockets of the state where lawyers are desperately needed. I'm Robbie Feinberg for Marketplace.
Last week, we talked about a sled dog kennel business. And today, we are really doubling down on the furry friend beat with a story focused on grooming, which turns out is a thriving industry. The U.S. pet grooming market is expected to shoot up to $14 billion by 2028. That's according to the market research company Brainy Insights. One huge reason for that growth is that, frankly, more and more businesses are getting creative, not just offering services in the salon, but outside of it, too. And that all brings me to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Brian Taylor. I live in Harlem, New York. I'm the owner of Harlem Doggy Day Spa, and I am the founder and organizer of the Pup Relief Tour. I was a banker that turned a dog groomer, so I used to always do my own hair. And when my father used to, you know, trim my hair before school when I was younger because we couldn't afford a barber, I used to go back and fix it so I wouldn't look crazy at school. So I always had love for hair. But I think the passion for animal and then the love for hair really got me into becoming a dog groomer. The beginning of the pandemic, I remember like it was yesterday, I lost like 90% of my business. So I have a really good following on my business page. So I was like, hey, listen, I'm starting the pandemic relief fund for pet parents who weren't able to get their dog groomed and they have lost their job. All I ask is for a donation in that. So people started donating to that. I've been able to utilize GoFundMe, and so far we have raised over $80,000. And those money is used towards creating the tour, getting people on the tour, you know, accommodations and food, and just giving them an experience where giving back and learning is such a big thing. So the way that we did the Pup Relief Tour is just that I used my mobile van.
And we started in New York, but unfortunately, the van just broke down. So we had to rent cars, and we rented two minivans, and we just drove those minivans from one location to the next location. You know, money has been really hard to raise. And the first tour, I literally still invest money into it when I don't raise enough money. The tour, we like it to be the end of July and the first week in August. This is the fun part. So right now, we're in this stage where we're planning the tour. Last year, I did it with me and one other person, but this year, I have two or three people who have helped organize the tours. And then from there, the first thing we do, we just put our fillers out to the pet industry and ask people who own salons if they'll be interested in hosting a tour. We start recruiting groomers, and I was able to reach out to a lot of African-American groomers who wanted to give back and also wanted to represent, you know, minorities in this space. And so far, we've already groomed over 1,500 dogs, and we've been to 12 states, and my ultimate goal is to do all 50 states and groom over 10,000 dogs. So that's what it is. It's a feel-good thing. It's a bunch of professionals, and you want to find a way to give back every year to a little bit of your service to people in need.
That was Brian Taylor in Harlem. By the way, we can't do this series without y'all, so please head on over to marketplace.org/myeconomy. Let us know what's going on in your economy. This final note on the way out today. So, I will admit that I actually did not watch the Oscars last night. I don't have cable, and I didn't feel like paying money to watch it. But I did wonder just how well it did relative to years past. Turns out more people tuned into the Academy Awards than last year. But that's not too much of a shocker, because last year was apparently the worst year for the Oscars. It had an all-time low of 10.4 million viewers. And this year's show, according to early numbers from Nielsen, will go down as the second least watched with 15.4 million viewers. Just for some context, before the pandemic, the audience had never fallen below 20 million viewers. Now, I will say, again, these are early numbers, and Nielsen did not indicate whether more people tuned in after Will Smith slapped Chris Rock. But you can imagine that probably, most definitely, had an impact. All right, we've got to go. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. And I'm Rima Reis. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.